Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, this week marks the 40th anniversary of the September 11 coup in Chile that toppled democratically elected Salvador Allende and installed the dictator Agustin Pinochet. We'll revisit what happened, explore the newest revelations, and how Chileans are dealing with their past now. Then, the realities of the Syrian war and what the effects of a U.S. strike might be. And finally, 2 months after the military coup in Egypt, the country's interior minister has narrowly escaped a bomb, and the military government is cracking down on protesters. What is the future of post-revolution Egypt? On September 11, 1973, 40 years ago this week, General Agustin Pinochet toppled Chile's democratically elected president, Salvador Allende. Allende had been trying to economically reform Chile, the longest-standing democracy in Latin America, which angered big businesses, and then, in turn, U.S. President Richard Nixon. How much do we know now about what really happened in Chile, and how is the country faring 40 years later? We're joined by John Dinges and Peter Kornbluh. John Dinges is a professor of journalism at Columbia University, an award-winning journalist, and the author of three books about Chile, including The Condor Years, How Pinochet and His Allies Brought Terrorism to Three Continents. Peter Kornbluh is the director of the National Security Archives Chile and Cuba Documentation Projects. He's the author of The Pinochet File, a declassified dossier on atrocity and accountability, and The Iran-Contra Scandal, the declassified history. Welcome, Peter Kornbluh. Welcome, John Dinges. Great to have you here.
It's good to be there.
Thank you for having us.
Let's start with a look back. Now, we're here in the 40th anniversary, the week of the coup in Chile. John Dinges, you were actually there living as a foreign correspondent at the time. How would you describe first pre-coup Chile and then what happened in the days preceding the coup?
The reason I went to Latin America was to be in Chile, and Chile was the story in Latin America, one of the biggest stories in the world, and what was going on was a revolution, and it was an incredibly unique an optimistic revolution because Salvador Allende was elected democratically with a minority of the votes in the popular election, but was then elected with a strong vote in the Congress. And he was attempting to introduce a revolution on the Marxist model, but using democracy. I like to describe it as circling the square. He tried to have the perfect revolution that would have all the best of the democratic system and the radical upheaval of the remaking of the economy, basically using fairly radical socialist principles. I arrived when it was starting to go downhill. The most optimistic times were the first 2 years. The economy was booming, and there was pretty much a live-and-let-live consensus by large sectors of the electorate, certainly the Christian Democrats and all of the left. The right wing, of course, was implacably against him, and of course, there was already plans for subversion going on, but by the time I got there, there was a very large protest movement starting, and by the end of the summer, our American summer, July, August, there were a lot of protests in the streets. There was some violence, but it was not people being killed. It was right-wing gangs attacking left-wing demonstrations. It was a nasty situation toward the end. People were thinking, is the coup coming? Is the military going to go over with the right and overthrow Allende? And there was a lot of divided opinion about that. When the top general, General Carlos Prats, resigned in August, that was the time that most people said, okay, the military no longer has the constitutionalist commander-in-chief, and this is really dangerous. But I don't think anybody, certainly nobody that I was with, really expected it in those days. What people were expecting was that Allende was going to pull the rabbit out of the hat again politically, which he had done many times before, and come up with some kind of a way out of the incredible economic crisis that the country was in, the incredible political crisis. And then on September 11th, I woke up, was going off to work, and was told that there were troops in the streets, and it was happening.
At the time when you were there, you probably did not have a sense that there was U.S. involvement in bringing about the coup.
Well, no, I wouldn't say. I had been accused of being a CIA agent enough. There was a lot of consciousness that the U.S. had been intervening in Chile. There were revelations that had been made about the ITT papers, the International Telegraph and Telegram Company papers had been revealed that showed that there was subversive action supported by the United States through that company. And so people were denouncing the CIA intervention. There was a lot of paranoia about it. And just being an American, you could be accused of being somebody who was working against the government. So, yes, we immediately thought that the CIA was involved in this, and we didn't have any proof. But people immediately thought, yes, the U.S. is involved in this.
Peter Kornbluh, you have read the declassified documents that were here in the U.S. to actually write the history about its involvement. Now, looking back at it, how would you say and why would you say the U.S. decided to support the coup?
Well, it wasn't that the United States decided to support the coup. It's that the United States decided there should be a coup even before Salvador Allende put his feet in the presidential office of Chile. He was elected, but long before, weeks before he was actually inaugurated as president, Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon decided this was bad for U.S. interests. It took years to get the documents declassified on what Kissinger's rationale really was, but a lot of the focus was on the fact, as John said, that Salvador Allende was democratically elected, and he was successful in redistributing wealth peacefully, in nationalizing U.S. corporate mining interests in Chile peacefully. His model was going to be one that was going to be emulated around the world, and as Kissinger wrote to Richard Nixon in a top-secret kind of options paper in early November of 1970, just the day after Allende was inaugurated, there would be an imitative phenomena that could change the world balance of power and affect U.S. interests dramatically. As he told Nixon, Allende has legitimacy, and we can't take that legitimacy away. The only thing we can do, essentially, is make sure that he fails so that his model is not one that other countries in the world, particularly countries in Europe like Italy, decide to follow. So the United States government, through the CIA, was trying to promote a coup even before Allende stepped into office and did anything as president of Chile. And that effort continued for the 3 years that Allende was president, Allende's 1,000 days, CIA covert operations, kind of a quiet effort to cut off economic credits, multilateral credits as well to Chile, make the economy scream was Richard Nixon's favorite, famous instructions to the CIA.
In your book, you had pointed out one particular person that was having these conversations who was a media mogul, Augustin Edwards. What was his role?
John can speak to this, too. Augustin Edwards was the richest man in Chile. He owned the leading newspaper, El Mercurio, and he was, and we have the documents on this issue that are very detailed. He became the leading collaborator with the CIA and the Chilean military to promote a coup and then to make sure that the Chilean military regime consolidated. The CIA, with the authorization of Richard Nixon, the president, funneled more than $2 million into El Mercurio to keep it going, keep it afloat. Augustin Edwards came to Washington, met with the CIA director, Richard Helms, at a downtown hotel. We've just recently recovered the memorandum of conversation of their meeting and discussed the issue of promoting a coup. And then CIA documents show that Edwards' kind of media empire was coordinating with the military and the protesters in the street to create a climate of uncertainty and instability as Chile's 9/11 grew nearer. One of the most dramatic documents that was declassified more than 14 years now in my book, The Pinochet File, is a CIA document after the coup in which they say that their propaganda effort to support Augustin Edwards was fundamental, critical to setting the stage for the coup of September 11th, 1973.
John Dinges, did you have personal experiences while you were there during the coup and after the coup that you could share?
Certainly, and I've written about it to a certain extent. I was an American expat. I was a freelance. I was really a nobody as far as journalism was concerned at that point. And the day of the coup, I got together with some friends that I was living with, Chileans and foreigners. We took off on foot. There were no buses running, to go up toward the Vicuña Maquena area, which was called the Industrial Belt. And that's where the workers' organizations were strongest. And if there was going to be resistance, if this thing was going to be pushed back, it would happen out there. Of course, We were also looking to see whether there was a division in the military, which, of course, did not happen. And so thinking that the last resort was the workers' organizations, who had been reported to be cashing arms, and that military resistance might happen from those factories. And we got out there. It took us, 45 minutes or an hour to walk out to this area. We got there, and there were buses full of soldiers with armbands showing that they were the coup soldiers, driving, back and forth. They weren't getting out yet in that area, but it was in a tremendous show of force. And people that we talked to said, basically, forget about it. People are going home. They're leaving the factories. And people were saying, no, this is not going to happen. Save yourself. Protect yourself. There was resistance in several factories, and there was a lot of killing. And there was at least one low-income area, La Legua, where there was a military resistance against the coup. But other than that, there was very, very little. That said, during the weeks and months after the coup, there were gunshots every night. There was a curfew, and after the curfew started, you could start hearing gunshots around the city. Of course, now we know that many people were being killed during that period. And in fact, my most recent investigation for an investigative organization that I started in Chile, Archivos Chile, documented the day-to-day killings in the streets and the bodies that were delivered to the morgue and in trucks and things like that. It was a horrendous, horrifyingly frightening situation. A lot of that shooting, I think, was to inculcate terror in people. They were killing people, no doubt about it. They killed probably up to 2,000 people in the first 2 or 3 months. But a lot of it was to give people the idea that any sign of resistance would be met with death. And in fact, there was almost no resistance. People were petrified.
And they still killed over 3,000 people and disappeared.
Over the period of the military government, the 3,000, about 1,000 of those were people who were disappeared. In that early period, the mass violence, the mass killings occurred, which was the majority of the killings, and that was in the first months. After that, instead of killing people and leaving their bodies around or taking them to the morgue, they disappeared the bodies. So people were captured by the secret police, taken to torture centers, secret detention centers, tortured, and then a number of those people, probably 10 to 20% of the people who were captured in that way, were then executed and their bodies were buried secretly or dumped into the ocean. That was the phenomenon of disappearances. Another terror tactic, which kept people would just disappear. A good friend of my wife's, who I had met, we were with them playing the guitar, and a week later they said, Alejandro is gone. Well, where is he? Well, he didn't come home. And weeks went by, no sign. Rumors came that he had been arrested. Maybe he was going to show up. Eventually, I actually, in my research for my books, came across a lot of information just on him, because he was reported inside one of these detention centers, and then at some point was taken off and killed, and his body was found about 10 years later. That's just one case of those 1,000 people that were disappeared. It was not the most people killed in Latin America by military governments, but it is the trademark of repression and the use of terror by the state in Latin America. And Pinochet achieved the reputation as the leader of this terrible wave of military governments that started after the Chilean coup, so that almost all of Latin America within a few years was under military rule.
Both of you have written about Operation Condor. Peter Kornbluh, you have a chapter on it in your book, The Pinochet File. And John Dinges, you wrote a whole book about it. Peter Kornbluh, why don't you tell us a bit about what exactly Operation Condor was?
John was talking about systematic violence and its evolution in Chile, with mass killings in the first 5 or 6 weeks after the coup, and then the creation of a secret police force, which then undertook very systematic and selective seizures, kidnappings, interrogations, torture, and disappearances. But there came a time when the Chilean secret police decided that some of their key enemies, of the state, and not just militants, but also ex-generals who had served alongside Pinochet before the coup, and civilian centrists who were now in exile in Europe, and other members of the Allende government that were even living in Washington, D.C., were their enemies and had to be hunted down and killed. There were other militant groups in the region that were trying to unite against all of the Southern Cone military regimes. And so the Chilean secret police, known as DINA, and its chieftain, Manuel Contreras, came up with an idea of coordinating basically a rendition, interrogation, and assassination program that was called Operation Condor. It was named at the first meeting of the heads of the Southern Cone secret police agencies for the National Bird of Chile, Condor, and referred to as Plan Condor. And basically, it was a coordinated cross-border, multinational secret police operation targeting militants and civilians in the region and as far away as Europe and the United States for kidnapping, interrogation, torture, and assassination. It came right to the capital city of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., on September 21st, 1976, when former Chilean ambassador Orlando Letelier and a young colleague, Ronnie Carpen Moffat, were assassinated by a car bomb. And John and Saul Landau wrote an incredible book about that very case.
John Dinges?
Well, Operation Condor was the effort to kill the elite. They had basically controlled things inside the countries, and going internationally was intended to take the anti-Marxist fight worldwide. It had three phases, first to track down the militants. And as Peter said, we're not just talking about left-wing revolutionaries. That was the pretext for the operation. There was an organization called the Junta Coordinadora de Revolucionaria, the Revolutionary Coordinating Junta, which was the alliance of four left-wing groups, including the Tupamaros from Uruguay and the MIR from Chile. And they were the primary target, and Operation Condor essentially liquidated all of their operations. They had arms factories. They were a very powerful military force, left-wing military force, completely obliterated by Operation Condor. But the secondary target, and probably, I think Peter would agree, the major purpose of Condor was to go worldwide to eliminate the democratic, highly popular opposition leaders, such as Orlando Letelier, who had tremendous access in Washington, D.C., as an opposition figure discrediting the Pinochet government. And the human rights, another target was human rights organizations, who were being incredibly effective in denouncing the crimes of these military governments. So the documents that I have, of course, the U.S. documents, but I also have collections of documents from Paraguay, documents from Argentina, military documents, investigations that were done in Europe, in which they interrogated many of the participants in Operation Condor, Italian terrorists, Cuban terrorists, anti-Castro Cuban terrorists, an incredible array of no-goodniks around the world whose one goal that Pinochet was fomenting was to eliminate Marxist leaders wherever they could be found, or people who were friends of Marxists. The idea of the fellow travelers were as much an enemy as the Marxists. They actually called this, in one document, one of the Uruguayan leaders called this struggle World War III. They thought that they were in a worldwide struggle to eliminate Marxism, and that the United States was not doing a good enough job in fighting back against the Marxist scourge, and that they had to take it upon themselves to go internationally to do this. Luckily, it was nipped in the bud after the Letelier assassination in Washington. The profile was raised so high, and I think to their great surprise, the United States did not go along with this, and the FBI investigated very, very strongly, solved the assassination. Actually, the FBI was the one that made public the existence of Operation Condor and its role in the Letelier assassination. Well, and as a result, the Operation Condor really backfired on the military governments because it raised their profile internationally, and these international operations began to be investigated not just by the FBI but other governments. And, you know, I think that was one of the important factors in leading to the ultimate discrediting and defeat of the military governments. Of course, it took many, many years.
It took quite a while for Chile to return to some form of democracy, and they have been trying to pursue justice. And I think, Peter, you've written in your article that something like 70 of Pinochet's military men are in jails. Something like 800 are either under investigation or indicted. We've got a presidential election going on right now that's almost like a pro-Pinochet and an anti-Pinochet daughter. How have they rebuilt, and how are they doing on the human rights enforcement aspect?
Well, I was just in Chile and just arrived home yesterday after spending 10 days there observing, reporting on, and participating in some of the 40th anniversary events that have been organized, and kind of summarized some of those in an article for the Nation magazine that is out right now. But Chile has an amazing confluence of political events. They're in the middle of a presidential campaign. It's a historic campaign because the two leading contenders are both women. But that kind of history-making, gender-breaking election is overshadowed by the family histories of these two women. One, Evelyn Matei, is the daughter of an Air Force general who stood alongside Pinochet and was a member of the four-member junta that Pinochet headed for a good part of the 17-year dictatorship. The other, Michelle Bachelet, who has already been president once, is the daughter of also an Air Force general, Alberto Bachelet. He opposed the coup, was arrested by his own colleagues in the military after the coup, imprisoned, tortured, and basically tortured to death in an Air Force base that was actually commanded by General Matei, Evelyn Matei's father. So you have in just the symbols of the two sides of democracy and dictatorship running now, many years after the dictatorship has ended, and inevitably the issues of the past have come up again and again and again in the campaign, at the same time as just a massive outpouring of commemorative events, rallies, speeches, cultural presentations, some of which are extraordinarily creative and poignant, are taking place literally every day in Chile right now. So it's a country that is confronting its past through memory and history, but it's also through a debate over its politics. And quite a number of the right-wingers and pro-Pinochet people who were very much involved in facilitating the dictatorship have now found it expedient to come out for the first time and apologize for their misconduct. The Association of Judges just 2 days ago issued a statement apologizing for not supporting the habeas corpus petitions that the victims' families brought to them day after day after day during the 17-year regime. And the right-wing political figures are starting to abandon Pinochet's ship in droves as well. So it's an amazing time in Chile after all these years.
John Dinges.
The Concertación was the government which brought together the coalition that had broken apart at the time of the Allende government. The left-wing parties, the Socialist Party, which is Bachelet's party, and the Christian Democrats governed for 20 years. And then in what really was a good sign of a successful democracy, the right-wing parties elected the current president, and he's been president for 4 years. And I think we're now into the third generation of Chileans who are dealing with their past. Younger people like the famous student leader, Camila Vallejos, who are coming to the fore and are grappling with the past, not with direct memories of it themselves, but stories that they heard from their parents. Many of them, their parents and grandparents were victims of the military, or in the case of the right wing, they grew up with the ideology of that the Allende government was the epitome of evil. And of course, on the left, growing up with the ideology that Pinochet was the epitome of evil. So this is a country that is still grappling with its memory, with its collective sense of itself, and it's not yet a unified country. I would guess that the center and left parties will elect Bachelet again. She's incredibly popular, and she has done a lot because of her military background to bring the country together. And I think this is the story, that the wounds are healing as the country works through this, sometimes with very rough edges. But now you're seeing a new generation of people raising new issues, certainly connected to the social issues of the past, but the student movement, the university, free education movement is incredibly important. It's populist, and it is a movement that is against both the Concertación center and leftist parties and, of course, against the right. So we're really entering into, with this 40th anniversary, we're entering into a new period in Chilean politics that's bringing Chile, in a sense, into the realm of the populist movements that we've been seeing in recent years in Venezuela, Ecuador, and Bolivia. Totally different kind of politics, progressive, to be sure, but not ideological, not Marxist. And I think there's a lot of nervousness among the established political people, certainly on the right, but of course also on the left, that the grassroots politics is getting away from them. And they see what's happening in the other countries, in Venezuela and Ecuador particularly, where parties have basically been discredited. The press has been under control. And they're saying, you know, what can we do to bring in the new political forces, the new progressive political forces, so that we continue to represent them, and they see us as representing them. It's a very interesting time in Chile.
Thank you so much for being with us, Peter Kornbluh and John Dingus.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you, Maria, for having us.
When we come back, the realities of the Syrian conflict and what U.S. action might mean. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. The war in Syria is much more complex than it is being made to be in the media and in official rhetoric, say our next guests, which further complicates any action by the U.S. And while the U.S. has hyper-focused on Syria, some worry that Egypt may be on a course that would reverse the revolution's gains. Three experts join us. Laurie Brand is a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California. She's the author of Palestinians in the Arab World, Institution Building and the Search for the State, and Women, the State, and Political Liberalization. Bruce Rutherford is with us. He's a professor of political science and the director of the Middle East and Islamic Civilization Studies at Colgate University. He's the author of Egypt After Mubarak, Liberalism, Islam, and Democracy in the Arab World. Fred Lawson is a professor of government at Mills College. He's the author of Global Security Watch Syria, Constructing International Relations in the Arab World, and Why Syria Goes to War, 30 Years of Confrontation. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. Thank you so much for being with us. Fred Lawson, let's start with you and your analysis on Syria. You wrote a book back in 1996 about why Syria goes to war, gave three explanations. Now, looking at the civil war today, do you think these still apply? And if so, how?
There are several different ways to think about the current civil war as having gone through different stages. We might count up different kinds of stages that the war has gone through. But however we do it, over the last 6 or 8 months, the fighting has taken a new dimension, a dimension that's much more dangerous, dimension that is fiercer than it has been in the past. One way to think about the new stage in the civil war is the radical militant Islamist movements, that have seized the vanguard of the opposition on the ground. So a different kind of opposition force is leading the rebellion than had led it in previous stages. Along with that, I think we see the mobilization of some of Syria's minority communities. The large minority Kurdish community has now gotten involved in the fighting and has organized political organizations and militias to fight for the interests of that community. The Turkmen community has organized a political movement. Even a group of tribes people out in the far northeast of the country have set up a liberation alliance as well. So a number of different forces are now contesting the ground that have conflicting interests and may well be, in the future, set against one another. And the final way to say what's going on in the current stage of the uprising is that with the rise of these militant Islamist movements, a number of minority communities, like the Christian communities, like the Kurdish villages, are finding themselves subjected to violence in a way that they had avoided before. We see whole villages being subjected to killing, whole villages being disrupted and forced to move out. And so the fighting on the ground has become more intense, more indiscriminate than it had been in the past.
Would you say the divisions then are ethnic and religious primarily? And are they fighting each other as much as they are fighting against one side or the other?
It's crucial to remember, I think, that at the beginning of the uprising was not particularly sectarian, wasn't particularly religious. There were people from various communities inside the opposition, and there were even people from different communities defending the regime or rallying behind the regime. And as the fighting has gone on, the fighting has become more religiously oriented. The religious character of the uprising is entrenched to a much greater extent now than it has in the past. So I don't think we should say that the civil war at the start was a sectarian conflict, but it's being sectarianized to a very great extent, and the sectarianization is gaining momentum just over these last couple of months.
Bruce Rutherford, what would you add?
I think all of Fred's observations are fascinating, and what strikes me in Fred's comments and more generally in observing what's going on is this whole question of the coherence of the Syrian state. And I think one has to begin discussing this question by keeping in mind both how recent the Syrian state is and how artificial it was. In other words, created in the 1920s by France, an external actor, essentially mushing together a number of sectarian religious groups, the groups that Fred was describing, into a single state. And over time, it became clear the only way those groups could be kept together was by creating a very powerful police state that could monitor and control the dissent with great rigor and great violence. I wonder whether the way to conceptualize this is that essentially that very fragile state that was patched together back in the 1920s is largely coming apart, and then the question becomes what is likely to be the successor to that state. Will we see a regime comparable to the Assad regime that emerges that essentially uses force to keep all these diverse groups together? Will we conceivably see Syria split up into different components, semi-states or micro-states? It seems to me unlikely that democracy is going to emerge in this environment, and perhaps that's the least likely outcome. But the whole question of the long-term viability of the Syrian state seems to me an important thing to think about, and under these circumstances, what would a viable Syrian state look like that might emerge from these current conditions?
Laurie Brand, would you agree?
Well, I wanted to comment on how important I think Fred's comments were for people to be thinking about as the United States is pondering undertaking military action, because the story that's told about what's going on in Syria, I mean, there's always a need, I think, to try and simplify things for a public that doesn't understand the complexities, perhaps, of Syrian history, as Bruce has begun to outline it. But I think that it's very problematic for people to think of sort of, the regime, and then on the other side we have an opposition which is either sort of Free Syrian Army or Jabhat al-Nusra, and our policymakers, they've latched onto Jabhat al-Nusra, and so they know two Arabic words, and so they like to reuse that, over and over again. But it's clearly far more complex. And the idea of intervening on one side in the way that the U.S. is currently contemplating or planning, I think just really underscores the degree to which the lack of a nuanced either understanding or willingness to understand with regard to what's happening in Syria could really lead to even more perverse outcomes than we're already seeing on the ground. I mean, this triangulation that Fred mentioned, I think, is extremely important. There were reports, we don't get to see much of this in the press, but there were reports about the fighting in the northeast with the Kurdish forces against the Jabhat al-Nusra. And so there's an extent to which the dynamic behind the way that the fighting has unfolded on the ground has a lot of very sort of local or particularistic elements to it. And I think that all gets lost in the way that it's being currently presented by the administration, and I think that's extremely dangerous.
The other conflict that the administration intervened in, which was Libya, are there any lessons to draw from that, or is it so completely different that we can't even look there? Fred Lawson?
I think the Libyan case is different in at least a couple of important ways. One way is that, as every school child knows, the Libyan uprising was concentrated in a territorial area. The rebels had a kind of safe zone in which they could group. The rebels had an area that could be defended or supported by outside air support. And in Syria, there's a patchwork of rebel territories. I'm not sure what would count as the zone inside Syria that outside forces could help to protect. And the other difference between Syria and Libya is that the Libyan forces, as diverse as they were a bit more coherent tactically. They seemed to be all on the same page. There was certainly not this deep division between an external leadership outside the country and the fighters on the ground inside the country. So in those two ways, the situation is really quite different. I was struck in the news, came across the newswire, that the new Libyan authorities have come out against foreign intervention in Syria, which sounds quite remarkable. We were thinking about what the Libyans have learned about their own case that they think would be hard to duplicate in Syria.
That actually leads to another question, which is the sort of Middle East dynamics with all of the various states and the allies and seeming enemies. How do we explain some of these? Why would Turkey, for example, sort of switch sides? How do we make sense of this? Lori Brand?
One of the things that struck me, I think it's a good way to encapsulate, at least in part, what's been happening in Syria, is that Saudi Arabia is willing to fight Iran to the last Syrian. So you have, I think, and this is also an important way in which the Syrian case is different from the Libyan one. Certainly there was external intervention in the Libyan case. It was certainly tilted the balance. It made the difference. But in the Syrian case, you have really sets of external actors on both sides lining up, and they're fighting out a series of issues of their own within Syria, which isn't to say that there wasn't, I mean, obviously they have tapped into what was an existing revolt against the regime, but then they're using this as a way of trying to fight out their own battles. And, you know, it's not at all clear. There have been various reports the last couple of days trying to figure out what the Obama administration is up to in Syria and whether what the, because they're choosing or apparently choosing a relatively limited sort of military engagement, if that's not part of a strategy simply to continue to bleed both sides. I think there was an Israeli commentator last day or so who's been saying that. So in the case of Syria, you have the Saudis and the Qataris and the Emiratis. You have these Gulf states interested in pursuing their conflict with Iran through Syria. And then, of course, you have Iran and Russia with their own sets of interests in trying to continue to promote the continuation of the Assad regime. So that's another way that various regional actors line up, or any even extra-regional actors line up in a way which is quite different, I think. The dynamics are quite different than they were in the Libyan case.
Bruce Rutherford.
I think those are all fascinating points. And perhaps the other step or the other consideration to look at here is more broadly, what is the American regional objective at this point in time with regard to the Syrian civil war and the form that our intervention takes? Is our objective primarily to send a message to Iran, which seems to be a big theme in the discussion that's going on in Washington right now? In other words, there seems to be lots of attention paid to the prospect of deterring Iran from finalizing the development of a nuclear weapon, and the rationale being that if we intervene in Syria, that will serve as a deterrent to Iran. But it could conceivably have the opposite effect. If we intervene in Syria, Iran may look at this intervention and conclude that they need to acquire a nuclear weapon as soon as possible in order to deter an American intervention. And so these really fundamental questions about how we interpret particularly Iranian objectives and how we manage our interests in light of those objectives are really very foggy at this point and make President Obama's decision even more difficult, simply because the understanding the objectives and responses of the key actors is so difficult at this moment.
There's been an argument made that Obama himself did not want to do this, but he's got sort of a human rights faction in his administration that's been pushing him to intervene. This is in the form of Samantha Power and Susan Rice, who are strong interventionists, whereas he initially wanted to stay out, but he made that red line statement, and now he's sort of using that. Do you see any legitimacy to that argument, Fred Lawson?
When the president made his red line comment, he made the comment about as broadly and vaguely as it could be done. As I remember, he said something like there needed to be the use of a whole bunch of chemical weapons or something like that. So left it up to a very subjective standard. And there have been reports over the last 6 or 8 months of chemical agents being deployed in the past, one way or the other, in some part of the country or the other. But this time around, really did look like something that was impossible to ignore, something that a president committed to international principles, someone who thought that the United States' leadership in the world rested on moral authority. This time around looks awfully hard to sweep under the rug.
You also wrote about this chemical weapons use and why it could be that Assad's brother actually used chemical weapons. First of all, there's been some debate about whether that is in fact what happened. And then secondly, if in fact that is what happened, why do you think it did?
I think we don't know how chemical weapons might have been put in play on the 21st of August. There are at least four possible ways that it might have happened. One way is President Bashar al-Assad may have picked up the telephone, called the military command, and ordered the military command to drop chemical weapons. And that's the way that the Obama administration is pitching the whole incident. A different way that things might have happened would be there might have been hardliners inside the regime, rivals of the president, people inside the regime who wanted to force the president's hand. Troops on the ground had been gaining momentum against the opposition over the last 3 or 4 months. So it might have been a moment when President al-Assad might possibly have thought of negotiating with the opposition, and so hardliners inside the regime might well have decided this is the time to make sure negotiations like that never happen, and therefore the hardliners gave the orders to drop the chemical weapons. A third alternative, I think, might be that local commanders on the ground, in the heat of battle, might have shot off an artillery shell or two. That seems unlikely. The Syrian Armed Forces is pretty well organized, pretty hierarchical, but it's been fighting a major insurgency, a major civil war, for 2.5 years, so maybe command and control has been degraded. And finally, maybe there was a tanker car or a warehouse or something that had been largely forgotten in the Damascus suburbs that got blown up during the intense artillery barrage in the early morning of the 21st of August. Now notice, either way, chemical weapons get released. Either way, hundreds of people get killed. But I think it matters a lot for United States policy which one of those causal chains actually generated the release of the chemical agents.
And it matters because one would be really highly intentional and from Assad, and the others are not so much. Is that what you're saying?
And as Bruce was saying, if the first line of argument is not what happened, then retaliating against the regime, retaliating against the president, might well radicalize the regime, might well make the regime feel like there's nothing to be lost by abandoning any restraint at all. Furthermore, if the third option is right, and if there's any possibility that local commanders might be in a position to release agents like that, then any attack that might degrade Syria's command and control structure might well free up local commanders to do something even more horrible the next time around. So it sort of matters how deterrence works, which one of those lines of argument is the correct one.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the conflict in Syria and the developments in Egypt. Now, the Syrian conflict has been really overshadowing some developments in Egypt, which last July we saw a coup. And one op-ed, I think this was in the Washington Post, suggested that this new regime is actually constructing another autocracy that would reverse the 2011 revolution. Laurie Brand, does it look like that is what's occurring?
I was in Egypt in June, so I was there as in the final days of the gathering of signatures for the Tamarrud, the rebel campaign, and I was simply struck at the time by the vehemence of the feelings among friends of mine, some people who I don't think was terribly political, the depth of feeling against the Brotherhood and the kinds of errors that they clearly had been making. I mean, going back to at the very least, Morsi's attempt to push through his constitution in December of 2012. But yeah, I was certainly struck by that. I was also, I must say, struck by what seemed to me an incredible vibrance of, you know, among civil society, all sorts of activities going on, discussions of various sorts in a way that I hadn't really experienced. My last visit to Egypt had been after the revolution, but relatively soon after the revolution. And so this was really quite revelatory for me. Now, as to what's going on currently, we really need to think about what it was that happened, how much changed in Egypt with the ousting of Mubarak in February of 2011. It's not that it was certainly an insignificant by any means, but the extent to which other structures of the Egyptian state, the security forces and so on in particular, were left intact, and many people who work on, you know, democratization were calling out early on for the need to reform the security forces. And of course, that didn't happen, and we see some of the results of that now. So there were changes at the top, and there certainly were some. We did have an exercise in democratic elections, and that was extremely important, but there was no provision, I guess, in the Constitution that was pushed through to recall a president, which is one of the reasons why the only way people felt that they could get rid of Morsi was through some sort of a campaign as they undertook. But I think one of the stories that remains to be told and explored is exactly what the role was of the forces that had been a part of the Mubarak regime as this Tamarrud campaign continued and as it moved into the 30 of June demonstrations and then into very shortly thereafter the military intervening and removing Morsi. So there's a lot to me which is still unclear, but what does seem to be the case is that we have an ostensibly civilian regime behind which the military is the major power. Security forces have come back with a vengeance. The discourse in Egypt is frighteningly chauvinistic, nationalistic, and the kinds of analyses that one hears from Egyptian commentators on Egyptian satellite broadcasts from people who, I mean, I won't talk about the people who weren't sort of to be trusted or weren't particularly sort of cogent or thoughtful in the past, but people of other tendencies, the kinds of things one hears that one simply would not have expected to hear before. And so the complete disappearance, I would say, of any kind of sort of participatory or open or, I forget, even democratic dialogue. I mean, it became very ugly very quickly. And I think those forces have been unleashed. And while one does, I've begun to see in the last several weeks, voices here and there expressing concern, but in general, I think that there is still this overwhelming support for strong security response, particularly the Brotherhood. And we see what's going on in the Sinai is in part a function of that and also a product of that. So it's very ugly. It's very upsetting. The only hope that I can draw out of the current circumstance is that perhaps this is simply another stage in the unfolding of what we will look back on in 5 or 10 years as an Egyptian revolution. But for now, it looks very depressing.
I understand the regime is trying dozens of people in military courts. It's shut down something like 3 TV networks. It's banning the Muslim Brotherhood. Bruce Rutherford, what do you make of this?
Laurie's insights are very valuable, and the only thing I would add is that fundamentally the spirit that informed the uprising in January of 2011 was the idea that if you could simply remove the repressive structures of the Mubarak era, that Egyptians could come together and create a more representative and a more accountable political and social order. And it seems to me after 2.5 years, the unfortunate conclusion is that that appears to have failed. In other words, the political system opened up, and in essence, Egyptians discovered that the divisions in their society were much deeper than many had realized. Divisions over core issues about the role that Islam should play in society, the rights of women and minorities, how the type of economic reform that should be undertaken, and so on. Those core questions have provoked such profound differences of opinion that Egyptians really were not able to come together well to be able to address them coherently, and in fact retreated into different camps. And that process, of course, was aggravated by the way that Mohamed Morsi chose to rule. But I don't think it's reasonable to attribute this regression simply to errors in judgment by Morsi. I think it's a reflection more fundamentally of the fact that Egypt is a more deeply divided society than many of us had realized. And the question going forward is whether, in fact, Egypt is likely to try and return to a genuine democratic experiment anytime soon, given that this experiment of the past year produced such a dismal outcome. Or are we instead going to see a slightly modified version of the Mubarak-era style of rule, perhaps with somewhat better respect for the rule of law, maybe somewhat greater judicial independence and so on, but fundamentally not democratic?
Fred Lawson?
I know that both Bruce and Laurie care a lot about the political economy of Egypt, and I trust that at some point they will help us to understand the conflict of interest between the Muslim Brothers-linked business people who thought there would be new opportunities and new ways to generate wealth after Mubarak is overthrown, and whatever clash may have erupted between those business people and the armed forces involved in the local economy. That's a crucial part of this story that's very hard to figure out from this far away.
Fred raises an extremely important point. The other large block in that, which he didn't mention, of course, is the interest of the army. You've got the army's interest, you have the Muslim Brotherhood interest, and then you had the remnants of the Mubarak state. And they all, I think, represent different potential parts of the Egyptian economy, some of which had, obviously, the Mubarak people who had freer reign up to February 2011. But it's not at all clear to me, with the exception of several of the truly big guns, the top ministers who've been removed and tried and so on, what's happened to those people and then how they figure into the unfolding political economy. The emphasis has tended to be on the relationship between the military and its economic priorities or prerogatives and the possibilities that the revolution may have opened up for Muslim Brotherhood business people who had a slightly different, not a statist orientation, but a more, you know, private sector orientation. I think we need to try and understand over the next few months and few years is exactly how these three different groups interact, and therefore, again, sort of to get back to my earlier point about the remnants of the coalition that supported Mubarak, what role they played in supporting Tamarud, and I'm not trying to suggest that the Tamarud was simply a front for them, but I do know when I was in Cairo in June, there was concern expressed by people who were with Tamarud about the possible taking over of their movement by the so-called Falul, the remnants of the Mubarak regime. And so I think that's a story that I haven't seen. Maybe it's out there and I haven't seen it yet, but I think that's something that we need to look into to try and understand better.
Given these developments, is there a role for the U.S.? What should that role be for the United States? Fred Lawson?
Well, a crucial question, and I'm still quite concerned that any particular faction, any particular party that the United States would overtly support would be tainted by outside support. I think one of the things we see in Iraq is that when the United States went into Iraq, sponsored the creation of a new government, all of the parties and all of the political figures that had close ties to the United States were instantly delegitimized. And I think that we're in danger of something similar happening in both of these more current cases.
Laurie Brand?
I think it's interesting currently in the Egyptian case that one has both sides claiming that the United States was heavily involved in supporting the other. And the level of anti-Americanism, anti-U.S. governmentism anyway, in Egypt is higher than at any time that I can remember in the past. The kinds of things that were said about the U.S. ambassador, claims that she was making deals with the Muslim Brotherhood to partition Egypt. I mean, just and something like that appearing not in some rag, but in El Ahram, which, of course, I guess you could call that a rag now. But in any case, the kinds of claims that were being made about the role of the United States have been such that it really is very difficult to imagine the U.S. doing anything sort of high profile or overt, making a positive difference in the Egyptian case right now. I mean, of course, we've suspended the delivery of some F-16s and cut off some economic aid. I still remain to be persuaded, although there have been some rumors of it, that the United States would take the step of cutting military aid. I think even during some of the darkest days of U.S.-Egyptian relations, there was always a desire to maintain some kind of influence, whether it was with food aid in the 1960s or currently with military aid. I would be surprised if the United States would make a decision to suspend that, but certainly the rhetoric coming out of Egypt is highly nationalistic, very much anti-American, anti-Western, and very much focused on Egypt's right to its own sovereign decisions, to do whatever it feels necessary in suppressing what it's defining as terrorism. And, of course, the United States is in no position to try and make an argument against that, given the kind of discourse that we have engaged in that's guided some of U.S. policy. So that's quite problematic. On the Syrian front, I think that, again, I don't claim expertise on Syria, but I think to the extent that the U.S. could be helpful in trying to bring parties together to be engaged in some kind of diplomatic efforts, because this conflict does not have a military solution. I think that's about the only thing that I could see that would be positive for the United States to do. I do not support any kind of military strike. I think it's not been well thought out. I think it's being considered for all the wrong reasons, and I think the potential impact has also not been thoroughly considered.
Bruce Rutherford.
I wanted to pick up on Fred's observation about economic issues and how that potentially could shape the way the United States thinks about trying to exert some degree of influence in Egypt going forward. I mean, something that's been striking about the last couple of months is the extent to which the Egyptian government has basically disregarded our advice on near-term political issues. The military has convinced itself that it faces an existential threat from the Brotherhood, and it's decided to suppress the Brotherhood in a very comprehensive fashion. So clearly our ability to influence these near-term political decisions is very limited. But in order for this new government to have any chance of success or gaining public support, it's going to have to produce fundamentally job creation. It's going to have to produce economic growth, but economic growth that creates jobs. One of the more striking statistics about Egypt is they need 600,000 new jobs a year just to absorb new entrants into the labor force. In other words, just to keep unemployment at its current level. And they have very little coherent strategy for achieving that objective. Morsi didn't have a solution. Mubarak did not have a solution. This is an arena where the U.S. could conceivably be helpful, partly through aid, partly through helping with economic restructuring and restructuring of firms, but I think fundamentally through access to our market. There's been talk over the years of the U.S. possibly creating a free trade area with Egypt or a free trade agreement in order to give them preferential access to the U.S. market. At this juncture, that type of access and that type of economic opportunity is something the Egyptians will value very highly because it would enable their government to create these jobs that are essential for stability. And that may well be the arena in which we can exert a measure of influence and perhaps contribute to enhancing Egyptian stability.
Thank you so much for being with us. Fred Lawson, Bruce Rutherford, Laurie Brand, appreciate your research, your wisdom. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Great to be with you, Maria.
Laurie Brand is a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California. She's the author of Palestinians in the Arab World and Women, the State, and Political Liberalization. Bruce Rutherford is a professor of political science and the director of the Middle East and Islamic Civilization Studies at Colgate University. He's the author of Egypt After Mubarak, Liberalism, Islam, and Democracy in the Arab World. Fred Lawson is a professor of government at Mills College. He's the author of Global Security Watch Syria and Why Syria Goes to War, 30 Years of Confrontation. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to the Scholar Circle team who makes this show possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, and Joe Pinto. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed a part of the show, you can go back either to the kpfk.org audio archives, or you can go to scholarcircle.org. You can hear us on iTunes and on Stitcher, and you can follow me at @Armudian.